Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Summer rucking, it happens so fast. Welcome back to the Ruck Podcast from The Times and Sunday Times. Once again, I'm your host, Alan Dimmick, where we've got a bit of a buffet as we keep track of all the summer tours. And wow, what a weekend. 4-0 to the Southern Hemisphere. So we're going around the camps to bring you the latest. First up, we head to Australia, where our very own Will Kelleher and Alex Lowe pick through the bones of a Wallabies win. The All Blacks ran up the score against Ireland, and the NZ Herald's Liam Napier joins us for a chat. It's then off to South Africa, where Brendan Nell gives us an update on all things box. And lucky us, our own Mark Palmer stops backpacking around South America long enough to fill us in on everything Scotland versus the Pumas. But first, here are the boys from Brisbane.
Sometimes when you walk away to work on yourself, that's the best revenge. The words of our spin class instructor in Brisbane ringing in our ears. The ruck is on the ground on the west coast of Australia. We've made it to the other side. And we've spun again. Alex, I'm here with Alex Lowe.
We have.
Correspondent of the Times. How's life in Brisbane, Alex?
So, well, that quote, I think, probably needs to be on the wall of the England changing room on Saturday, doesn't it? When you walk away to work on yourself, it's the best revenge. It's exactly what England need to be doing in Brisbane this week. I'm good. My legs are a bit wobbly after that spin class. But I do think we need to point out, we've had some contact from friends, some worried other journalists around the world, our friend Brendan Nell in South Africa being one of them, concerned that we might be on a major health kick wellness tour. I can confirm that we're doing our best to just maintain levels. There has been a birthday party. There's been we were entertained by Tourism Western Australia. They showed us the sights, a nice craft beer place. So I can assure people who are worried that tour traditions are being maintained. But listen, we're getting a bit older. We've just got to do our best to try and stay a little bit healthy while we're out on the road.
Right. So yes, we've been getting our retaliation first with the exercise, but now we've talked about that and life on tour, let's talk about Saturday night. So for us, we're recording this on Monday night.
We should say that while we go on tour, just before we hit record, we got the news that Tom Curry's tour is over. He failed an HIA at half-time in the first test, which was about half an hour later than we thought he might be undergoing one. It looks like that collision, I don't know if you saw it, with Samu Karevi 14 minutes in which his head snapped back rather alarmingly, led to him presenting symptoms at half-time. We think he probably would have been unavailable for the second test anyway because of the new protocols where, other than exceptional circumstances, players have to stand down for 12 days. But England have decided to send him home. He had a concussion in the Six Nations, went off at half-time against Wales, and for player welfare reasons, for his own recovery, he's out of the tour. So the conversation over here now is, in terms of looking forward, is who comes in. We were just chatting with Erwill. We think, well, they're not calling anyone else out. So their options are Lewis Ludlam, who is the best ball carrier of the three contenders, Sam Underhill, most experienced, best defender, biggest tackler, or Jack Willis, who is the best over the ball. And the breakdown was an area of real issue for England, wasn't it, on Saturday?
Disaster. And I know from our coverage and from elsewhere and lots of social media stuff, there's a lot being made about Owen Farrell and Marcus Smith, but having chatted with you over the last couple of days, Alex, we kind of think that while that is a big issue, the breakdown and the speed of ball that Danny Kerr didn't get from it always contributed to the fact that they couldn't get on the front foot. So, I mean, there was something that Dylan Hartley said in the Times on Saturday. There's a lots of things around Australia that want to kill you: spiders, scorpions, snakes, and Michael Hooper. He was the menace, wasn't he? I mean, unbelievable. He actually only won one jackal turnover, but it was with one hand on the goal line that denied an England try that I think if they'd scored it about 56 minutes in may have been the straw that broke the camel's back. Mm. But against Australia, you've got to win the ball on the floor. So if it were me, I think I would lean towards Willis or Ludlam rather than Underhill. But what would you say?
Well, the other sort of option, which we don't think they'll do, is that you sort of try and recreate the kamikaze kids from the World Cup and you play Underhill and Willis or Ludlam, and, or you play two of the three. To do that, you have to move Courtney Laws into the second row. And whenever you mention Courtney Laws about him playing in the second row, he puts you right as quickly as he possibly can that he doesn't see himself as a lock anymore.
He hasn't played this since the 19 World Cup, he always says.
Yeah, I think he got moved there, didn't he, in the Ireland game when Charlie Yules was sent off. And he did not enjoy it very much at all. So although to the rest of us that looks like a possibility, it would certainly change the dynamic of the back row. Eddie Jones would have to persuade his captain to go and play in a role that he doesn't want to do and doesn't see himself as. You know, one of Courtney's issues is staying heavy enough, and he's not really heavy enough to play in the second row. But of course, it's always a balance. What's more important for England in this second test? Is it having a third line-out option, or is it being an improved breakdown? I would really like to see Jack Willis play, because I just think the form he's shown coming back from that horrendous injury has been just outstanding. And Eddie Jones has had him straight back in as soon as he could. Sam Underhill's had a good season in a rubbish Bath team. He's been one of their rare shining lights. I think whenever I saw him play, he was pretty much doing all he could, fingering the damn stuff at times for Bath. And Lewis Ludlam has had an awesome season for Northampton and made a real impact, certainly as a carrier coming off the bench. But I would just, I'd just like to see Jack Willis given a go in a big test, which he hasn't had yet. I think he's earning it. I think he's earning that right. And they'll play Billy at eight, and they'll go Courtney at six, and I think they'll probably demand a bit more of everyone else. You talked about that Michael Hooper turnover. Brilliant. He only did split second in with one hand, and he was involved in the turnover towards the end, which was sort of one of the last daggers in the heart for England, I think, when Chesson had carried it. And the reason he got there was England's detail wasn't accurate enough. I think Jamie George slightly overran, fell off Ludlam and opened the door to Hooper. So they need the detail to be right across the team. And if they can combat the Wallabies on the floor and make it cleaner and quicker, that will help Smith and Farrell. Now there's a whole another conversation, isn't there, Will?
Yeah.
Which you know, we're a couple of days on here now. It's Monday night. If we think back to Saturday night, as I sort of try to put it right in the paper today, like if you stop the game after an hour, you think there's only one winner. England hadn't been great. Smith and Farrell hadn't been great, but they were just building the momentum, and you thought, well, Hooper can't keep winning goal line turnovers, and there's only one winner. And once you press play again after an hour, it turned on a sequence. It turned on Corabetti winning that restart over Jack Noel, the first time that Australia hadn't kicked straight to Freddie Stewart.
And he was left on his own.
Left on his own. Suddenly Karevi's piling forward, and you really realise the value of having that power player in midfield that England don't have. And they tried to create with Joe Cocker-Singer being picked, but he just didn't show up, really, for me, disappointingly. And then it brings us to the conversation of midfield balance, which has been a constant discussion, hasn't it?
11 years.
You know, Smith and Farrell, and you know, they've only played together twice. Like, yeah. I know the system's been in place through the Six Nations and with Slade, but these two have only played together twice. And we've already got calls from Clive Woodward, Lawrence Dellaglio, Will Greenwood, yeah, that England can only play one of them. I mean, I think if you look at the players on this tour, you drop a Smith and a Farrell, I don't think you're making the team better by picking, as good as they are, a debutant midfielder, whether it's Dingwall or Porter,
no, or
Freeman out of position. So Eddie's going to stick with these two. The question is, really, Will, I mean, you've watched a lot of Harlequins this season. We've seen Farrell coming back with Saracens. And actually, as we discussed, I think, was it last week after the name of the squad, looking like he was trying to evolve his game. And he's spoken about one of his regrets through his career was not playing what he sees as much.
Thinking about the system and the phase that was coming next rather than one he was actually playing.
So the post-match discussion on those two was whether it can ever work. If you've got a player who's, once the pressure's on, a player whose instinct is pattern and shape, and a player in Smith whose instinct is, let's, you know, go and attack the line, make things happen. Can they find a common ground where their instinct becomes the same? Now, I mean, we talked to Owen Farrell afterwards. He said that's their challenge, really, that they need to find somewhere where they can becoming, that it gets ingrained in them. What's your view on those two? Because you studied them after the game, particularly, I guess, in the build-up to that Tom Curry break.
I think that lots of different points to make on Smith-Farrell. I would say, firstly, they tried that same play four times in the first 15 minutes where Farrell's at 10, they've got a couple of forward runners next to him to go in front and distract the defence, and then Smith comes round the back. And it actually worked really well because they threw that one, two, three, four times, didn't really get anywhere, someone dropped a pass, whatever happened. But then on the fifth one, they threw it to the front and Curry, and he goes through the hole and they almost score in the right-hand corner with Marchant, although Corabetti nails him. So that was, as you were saying, if you were playing a tape and you said, this is an England victory, you go, okay, yeah, that. It's almost like
it's
watching someone playing football and they have loads of chances, they just miss, and then you think, right, and if they win 2-0, you go,
yeah,
okay, well, that was what was happening.
That was a setup. Like, they set up the Aussies with that and it worked. They just didn't score from it.
Yeah.
But it worked.
But then just going back to the sort of dynamic and talking about the midfield, I think it was something we were discussing a bit earlier before we pressed record. The blueprint from England's best period under Eddie Jones in 2016 and 2017, where they only lost one game in 1.5 years, was actually quite a lateral 9-10-12-13. It was Danny Kerr or Ben Youngs, more so Youngs than Kerr. It was Ford and Farrell, which changed a couple of times and didn't work, like Burrell coming in and then getting substituted off in Australia. And then Jonathan Joseph at 13. There was no Manu Tuilagi, he wasn't fit. Johnny May wasn't fit. They had sort of Watson, Noel, Marlon Yard and Mike Brown around that. And as you said right at the top of this, they needed more from other players. And that's exactly what they had then, because they had Billy and Macovinopola. They had Courtney Laws is carrying. They had Robshaw and Haskell smashing people. And actually, lots of the deficiencies of the back line, I think, are being caused by the forwards not doing their job. And the carrying needs to improve massively. Genge worked hard. Noel worked hard, I think. Ludlam, when he came on, worked hard. But they need more. They need more Courtney. They need more Maratoje. They need Billy was pretty good as well, but they need that game line, because if you don't have that, there's no platform to play off. And actually, some of us spoke to Danny Kerr after the game, and he would probably say a bit more if he was still on the podcast that he's on rather than playing in England 9 jersey, but he was saying that clearly he wants quick ball. And there were so many occasions where he's fiddling about at the back of a ruck, looking for it, where's the ball, what's happening, and sort of glancing out to Smith to see where he is. With that, at Harlequins, there's no glance, he just knows. And there was a point, actually, that Eddie Jones makes slightly mischievously, which I think we mentioned on the Ruck last week, about the halfbacks of the Australian team possibly being a little bit disconnected, whether that was between Nick White and Quade Cooper. And we know that Quade Cooper didn't actually play the game in the end. But you made the point the other day, Alex, when we were writing up stuff, that perhaps that's England's problem. That Smith and Kerr are on the same wavelength, but possibly instinctively Farrell isn't. And it does need time, but the problem is with England at the moment, they don't have time. They need to turn this round in now 5 days, and if they don't win on Saturday, then you're staring down the barrel of 3-0 and regime change. And that is just a fact.
Yeah, and Eddie's not been helped in this process by Farrell being injured for the whole season, and he's tried to implement a system, like we said, that had Slade in it. It's tough because we're now... Yeah, England are in a hole. Eddie's got his back against the wall. The pressure is at its greatest in 4 years. If we think back to the 2018 tour of South Africa, you know, the parallels are stark, really. England won 2 out of 5 in that year's Six Nations.
And the same two.
The same two.
Wales and Italy.
They got beaten at home by the Barbarians before they left quite heavy. That was the game that the Lashton scored his hat-trick. They came on tour with a new official captain in Farrell at that point. And they went 1-0 down in that series. And then they went 2-0 down in that series. And then Danny Cipriani got picked in the third test. And they ground out a win with that little moment of magic from him in the rain in Cape Town. And they did rebuild from there. And that was a massive turning point, that tour, because Scott Weismantle had joined the England management team in South Africa, and while they were in South Africa, Eddie Jones recruited John Mitchell, and he brought in two senior coaches who made a big difference to that England setup. He's not going to be bringing any coaches at this point, we don't think, although that's probably always a possibility. But he needs the same bounce, he needs the same turnaround, and he could really do without it coming in the third test when they're already 2-0 down, because patience is running out. And it's not just results, it's the manner of results. You've studied it more closely today, Will, but the way that they collapsed after an hour and lost that final quarter, it's like they lost belief and all kind of... They lost their grip on the game. And that is not the first time that's happened, is it?
You
know, that final quarter issue for England is becoming a major problem.
So just going through the last few games in this calendar year, let's start in Scotland. 60-minute mark, England are 14-10 up, lose the final quarter 10-3, lose the game. Italy, they win the final quarter 7-0, fair enough, and win the game 33-0. Wales then, the 60th-minute mark, they're 17-5 up, lose the final quarter 14-6 and almost lose the game. Ireland, slightly different context with that one because, as we all know, Charlie Hall's got sent off. They were drawing at the 60-minute mark, 15-all, lost the final quarter 17-0, lost the game. Then France, you go to the final quarter. France is slightly ahead at 18-13, lose the final quarter 7-0. Good night, Vienna. Then the Barbars, they were a bit further back and got even further back on that one. They were 31-21 and then lost the final quarter 21-0, which was stark. And then last Saturday, 14-9 man advantage, lose the final quarter 21-14, conceding 21 straight points. So
it's like every game bar Italy this year they've lost the final quarter.
Yeah, which is not great. And I'm looking at some stats and bits and pieces for the Mall Monday Mall for Time subscribers I've done this morning, and this year of all Eddie Jones's year is their worst in terms of conceding points in the second half. They averaged conceding about 12.5 points in the second half, and their previous worst year was last year. So this is now not an anomaly, this is a theme. And actually, it's something that seriously needs to be arrested quite quickly. But what I think the next point I'd like to make is, how big a week is this for the leaders and for Eddie? If this is going to be his last sort of couple of weeks to prove that he should be the England coach.
Well, first of all on that, there's no indication from anyone at senior at Twickenham that there's any inclination to make a change. I just think that if it goes 3-0, then the volume and the will grow to such an extent that they'll have to at least listen to the reaction. And like I say, it's not just results. England don't have a divine right to win matches. Like, we have to, you know, obviously they don't. And they're allowed to lose games and play well. That's sport. I don't think people criticise that. It's the manner, and it's whether there's a belief that this project, that Eddie Jones, this latest project, I mean, he's had a few since 2019 under the banner of create the greatest ever rugby team, which England are just light years away from, whether there's a belief that the project that he's working on, particularly with the attack, can bear fruit at the World Cup next year. And what Eddie will always argue is that the system in England does not help him. The access he has to the clubs and the players when they're at their clubs does not help him. But when he gets them all into camp 3 months out from the World Cup, that's where he makes his enormous gains. That will be his argument the whole way through, and his firm belief. Frankly, I mean, he's not just making up. You know, that is his firm belief that his best opportunity to improve England will be those 3 months before the World Cup. That said, this is a massive week. It's a massive week for so many reasons. It's a massive test of this new kind of captaincy leadership dynamic that has evolved with England. You know, a year ago, he'd moved away from the Saracens cabal, which he found because of the salary cap, and then the year in the Championship, he found that was toxic, and deliberately moved away from them. Now, most of those players are back now, bar Elliot Daly, but they're not in leadership positions, or certainly official leadership positions. I think Maro Itoje now is, although he never actually got dropped. It's a big test of this new kind of leadership vision, which is a bit more chilled out, a bit more Courtney Laws, a bit more
Ellis Genge, I suppose,
a bit more
well,
inclusive,
yeah.
A bit less intense.
Allowing people to be themselves is what Courtney was talking about last Friday,
which is obviously an important thing, but it's a test because a change has happened, and people will be looking at the leadership and looking at the change and looking at weeks like this where England need a reaction. They've talked a lot. You know, they've talked about they're going to get better. They've talked about how hard they work. They've talked about visions and goals, and it's time for action. Like, they've got this week, they have to deliver. So it's a big week for Courtney Laws.
Yeah.
It's a big week for Ellis Genge. I mean, Ellis Genge is delivering himself, but it's a big week. It's a big week for Smith and Farrell.
And sometimes when you walk away to work on yourself, Alex, that is the best revenge. I think they should all go down to Brisbane and have a spin class like us, work on the leg, maybe get the legs out of the system, you know, come on. Come on, everyone. Right. So we'll try and be a bit slightly more positive about the team when the team's out on Thursday, but we will come back to you from Brisbane. The sun has gone here. We're 2 hours a bit further ahead than Brisbane, so we're going to go and find some dinner.
And you're heading up the coast tomorrow.
And I'm heading up the coast, yeah, the Sunshine Coast. It's been a bit wet and grey, but hopefully by Thursday, apparently it's turning. Perth was very nice, wasn't it, and sunny.
It was. The Wallabies are based a bit out of town here up at the Sunshine Coast, and Will has very kindly volunteered to head up. I can't quite imagine why.
The few of us who have got another man here from newspapers have thought it'd be quite nice to have a byline in the newspaper that says Will Kelleher at the Sunshine Coast, because that looks quite nice, doesn't it?
Don't forget your trunks.
But it's actually, on that note, actually, with the Wallabies, quite a nice piece of news this week that they're going to be wearing their Indigenous jersey to represent the First Nations people of their country. So it's a cool design, that, and they had a smoking ceremony, didn't they, today? I'm going to go and see what they're up to tomorrow, which is Tuesday for us, but hopefully that has been a fine report from the ground in Brisbane for all of you ruckers back home. And we'll throw now back to Al Dimmock, because we know he's talking to lots of other people about lots of other tours, because there's been lots going on.
Interesting stuff from Oz there, particularly about Tom Curry heading home. It's just worth noting, we're away to hear a bit of a chat with Liam Napier from the New Zealand Herald, who gives us an update on Johnny Sexton. And it's interesting to bear in mind what's happened with Tom Curry going home with the new mandatory stand down for 12 days with a head injury. Johnny Sexton, you might remember, went off in the game against the All Blacks fairly early. We're getting updates about the state of his return to play. A couple of players in the Ireland squad have been stood down for 12 days. We're told that Johnny Sexton may be available for the second test. It's worth bearing that in mind as we listen to what Liam has to say here.
So, Liam, the reports of the All Blacks' death greatly exaggerated. How have you found the start of this test window for the ABs?
Yeah, I guess there was a lot of pressure on the All Blacks, wasn't there, coming into what's been a really highly anticipated home series against Ireland. All three tests are sold out here, and that's probably a reflection, I guess, of the interest, but also the pressure that the All Blacks are under following what was their worst season in 12 years last year, successive losses to end the season to Ireland and Dublin and France and Paris. So, you know, there's a lot of heat on the team and the coaching staff to respond. And they did that in the first test at Eden Park, a convincing victory. It was a wee bit of a shaky start, but they kicked into gear in the second quarter. And by halftime, they were, you know, ahead 28-5, scored six tries by the finish against the Six Nations best defensive team. But I think you probably saw enough from Ireland. They got in behind the All Blacks at times, and I think, you know, they will be better in the second test, but certainly a pleasing start for the All Blacks and a lot of pressure relieved on Ian Foster and his coaching staff.
I mean, I've been in New Zealand when there's been pressure on the home side, and it, you know, it can get quite heated. But did anyone really see the All Blacks putting 40 points on a team the caliber of Ireland? I mean, did that catch anyone unawares?
Yeah, I think there was, you know, widespread surprise at certainly the margin of victory. Most people gave Ireland a good chance. Certainly, I thought that their best chance in this series was the first test. Leading into this test, the All Blacks had a number of complications and disruptions. They had 7 COVID cases within their team, 3 players and 4 coaches, including head coach Ian Foster, forwards coach John Plumtree, and a couple of others. So they basically weren't with the team the whole week. They only came out of isolation. We've still got 7 days of isolation if you get COVID in New Zealand. So they were away from the team, sort of, you know, beaming in via Zoom meetings. So basically the senior players and a couple of assistant coaches, Joe Schmidt, got the call up. So that certainly spiced up the build up from an Irish perspective. So there are a lot of, you know, disruptions around the team, but they sort of put that to one side. And yeah, everyone was very, I think, nervous. Anxious was probably, you know, a good way to sum up All Black supporters leading into that game. Ireland had previously won 3 of the past 5 against the All Blacks. They'd never won in New Zealand, but they won the last test in Dublin. So there's certainly a lot of respect for Ireland. And I guess, you know, they've certainly earned the nemesis tag, I guess, for the All Blacks in recent times. So I think, yeah, there was a certainly surprise at the final margin of victory.
Really? I mean, it's at Eden Park. I think we were in very short trousers the last time the ABs lost there. But obviously, one of the hallmarks of this game was the way that New Zealand really turned up the heat in that first half. I think there was a period of 8 to 10 minutes where there was just 3 tries, boom, boom, boom. Where did that come from? But okay, it's a hell of a question, that, because certainly we've seen them turn on periods of extended pressure. But, you know, considering how much nervousness was around this game, what do you think that contributed to that period where they were firmly on top?
It's interesting because they were on the back foot from the start. Keith Earls scored the opening try, and, you know, that raises the tension and nervousness. But the All Blacks sort of, I guess, settled into their work. They started getting their line speed on defence. I think that's where they got a lot of their success from. Sevi Reese's counter-attack try. We know how lethal the All Blacks are from turnover position and counter-attack, and we saw that a couple of times. That's probably where they got their game going initially. Sevi Reese's, you know, ran 80 metres to score. That was a real turning point. Jonathan Sexton went off at that time as well, and Ireland became, you know, a bit rattled. And then the All Blacks isolated Ireland in their 22 and counter-rucked. Jamison Gibson-Park sort of went for a scoot off the line out and got turned over. And then the All Blacks scored from there. They also brought in a new sort of attacking structure where they pushed the ball to their ball carriers, their forward ball carriers, three wide of the ruck, and that allowed them to get outside Ireland's sort of initial rush, a bit more time and space, and allowed them to free up the edge guys. So that was quite a significant shift. Andy Farrell noted that that's an area they'll have to tidy up. So yeah, that was a real turning point, that sort of the second quarter of the first half, as you mentioned, three tries and some really big performances from the likes of Aaron Smith, Artie Sevier, just really, you know, coming into their own, and a beautiful grubber from Bowden Barrett and behind the Irish defence for Quintipaya to score. And really by halftime, the game was done. There was, you know, Ireland showed a lot of fight, but they were never going to come back and win that match at 28-5 down at halftime.
Where does the credit lie from a coaching point of view for that attacking tactic? That's, you know, it's, we've seen so much, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere, we've seen so much of that sort of blitzing style defense, to come up with tactics that counteract that. I mean, everyone in the world will be paying attention. Where does the credit lie for that?
Yeah, I think Foster's got to take a lot of credit, because, you know, he takes the heat as well. And I guess there's been frustrations with the All Blacks that they've been stale and predictable. And we saw that on the Northern Tour. Their forward runners just got picked off. They got trapped behind the gain line. Their ruck ball was so slow. And then Bowden Barrett and their playmakers were just swarmed. So they you know, it was a snowball factor of issues when it came to being unable to get around that real oppressive rush defence. So this is one tactic that they've come up with to sort of, I guess, negate that, and it worked well for them the other night. But I'm sure Ireland will go away and you know, counteract that again. So it's that's the beauty of a three-test series, isn't it? You get to see that the chess match play out, and the tactical element, the strategy. So the All Blacks, it was a real win for their initial analysis, and it's going to be really intriguing to see how that evolves throughout the series.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'd call this one a chess match, but the sort of arm wrestle at the breakdown, you know, stopping things at source tends to be a big focus in Test rugby. Andy Farrell had some bits and pieces to say after this game about the referee's interpretation. You know, did the All Blacks get one up there? And do you think that we expect interpretations to change through the series?
Yeah, it was an interesting one, because you had an English referee, Carl Dickinson. So, you know, you'd think potentially that the Irish should have been more in tune with his interpretations than perhaps the All Blacks. So, but yeah, he wasn't happy, I guess, with rulings around the gates and the ruck. And I guess discipline did contribute to Ireland's downfall. They invited the All Blacks.
How much do you think that would be frustration just at the fact that they got one up, though?
Yeah, I think, you know, you come out and you hope to have an element of control and an advantage there with a Northern Hemisphere referee. So the breakdown's so crucial, isn't it? That's the source where you shut the All Blacks down. You slow their pill, you frustrate them, you suffocate them. That's been the blueprint. So Ireland couldn't do that, and that they need to. So they need to find a quick fix there this weekend.
What do you expect to see with the New Zealand in this next week then? Obviously, Ireland will want to change. They're going to have, it looks like they'll have a different fly half, because with the stand down period now changed to 12 days, and Johnny Sexton, with his history of head injury, well, you know, we're not going to see him again. So how do the All Blacks prepare for that? Does it matter to them? Do they just keep rolling with what they've got? Do you expect to see big changes? What does the week ahead look like, do you think, for the ABs?
It's an interesting scenario with Sexton. Andy Farrell sort of suggested that while he failed his initial HIA, he passed the second one, and he was hopeful that he passed his third. So we initially thought he'd be ruled out for the tour, but perhaps not now. And I thought Joey Carberry was pretty good when he came on, was unlucky, probably should have been awarded his try. In my view, I thought he had control of that. So he brings a different style that the All Blacks would have to open up to. From an All Blacks perspective, they should get back guys like David Havili and Jack Goodhue, who were ruled out through COVID. Will Jordan was another, but he was later in the week, so he's probably not going to play this week. David Havili was expected to start at second five before picking up COVID, but I'm not expecting widespread changes for the All Blacks. I think they'll want to win the series first and then perhaps change things up for the third. There was a lot of conjecture over Scott Barrett's selection at Blindside. That was the first time he'd played there for the All Blacks since the 2019 semi-final defeat against England. So there's a lot of speculation about whether that was the right move. But I think it's something that you could probably see a lot more of in the future because it worked well from a ball carrying, from a defensive perspective. He's a big man, particularly against the likes of Ireland, France and South Africa. The All Blacks need that big body just to carry and clean. So it was a big tick for the All Blacks because, you know, there's a lot of pressure on I guess, that selection and whether it was the right move. But they'll certainly have a big tick in their book. And I think you'll see him there, provided he doesn't get cited, because there was one incident where a shoulder to the head sort of cleaned out near his own line. He's got a bit of form there, so interesting to see whether he gets cited or not.
Yeah, the citing commissioners around the world are going to be getting a lot of attention throughout these summer series, I would imagine. I was just wondering if you could just give us a note on the captain, Sam Kane. I mean, being the All Blacks skipper, always comes with a lot of scrutiny, but it seems particularly strong in his case. How did he show up?
Yeah, so he's had a pretty disruptive year. He had a second kid, but he also had a knee injury that, coming into this test, he played, you know, the one game for the Chiefs off the bench in the Super Rugby semi-final against the Crusaders in the past sort of 5 weeks to a month. So he was a bit underdone, but he played 67 minutes, defended well, led well. So it was a big tick for Sam Kane. And also throughout the week, I guess, when you're missing your head coach and assistant coach, a lot of responsibility falls on the senior players and the captain to bring the team together and sort of, you know, hold the fort, so to speak. So, yeah, it was a good start for Sam Kane. And as you mentioned, there's always a lot of pressure and scrutiny on his role, particularly when you've got guys like Artie Sevier and Dalton Papali'i and, you know, some real depth in those open side positions. So it was a real tick for Sam Kane, and he should get better from here with the game time, because he, you know, leading into this match, he was certainly underdone. So he should be better for that performance.
Well, Liam, it's always nice to get your calming demeanour on record here. Hopefully we'll catch up with you again later in the series to sort of test the temperature down under.
Look forward to it, Dims, and hopefully Scotland can pick up a win for you in Argentina.
You had to throw that in there at the end.
Thanks to Liam for that. And yes, we will get to Scotland versus Argentina. We're going to have a little bit of a stay of execution first, though, because next we're heading to South Africa to hear from Brendan Nell. We're now joined from a car park in South Africa by Brendan Nell. First, a bit of a review of the last test. I mean, that was a proper game of rugby, wasn't it?
That was a huge game of rugby. And I must admit, I think a lot of the South Africans, well, not just fans, the players were probably surprised with the intensity that well brought. And there's some of us that have been saying it the whole week, but you know, unfortunately, there were a couple of, you know, voices out there that wrote Wales off straight away. And I think we all, some of us who've been around longer, know that that's rather stupid, because they are a quality team. And especially if you just look at the names in that back line, I mean, there's some real quality there.
So how did, from your point of view, how did South Africa manage to squeak it? I mean, there was a bit, you know, Wales really threw a lot at you. And even with a couple of players down early on, it was eeksy peeksy. So how did South Africa get across the line?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think it's no secret how South Africa play. And when to stop them, you need to stop their strengths. I think Wales did that pretty well in that first half. I mean, they got two good, well, one was a bit of a lucky try from a South African point of view, but the first one was an excellent try. And South Africa didn't get their rolling ball going. They didn't get the reward from the scrums. And generally, some very poor tactical kicking, to be very honest. I thought, a lot has been said about Elton Jantjies, but he wasn't very good on the day. But he wasn't the only one. The rest, Faf de Klerk's tactical kicking wasn't good. And at one point, Wales had 70% possession, and they acquired a team, so they made the most of it. I just thought the box were extremely poor in that first half, and tactically, they looked extremely rusty.
Yeah, a lot, you're right, a lot has been made of Elshin Yanchis and how he played. Obviously, a lot of talk about the lack of high-intensity rugby that he's played in the last half year or so. How much did it change to have a reliable player like Willie LaRue come onto the field? And what did you make of Willemse when he moved across?
Well, I thought you know, the Box have been talking about Villa as a project player, as another Frans Steen. You know, the guy that gives them the 10, 12, 15 on the bench. And he's an extremely talented player. But in the first half, he also looked a bit nervy. He put in a few strange kicks and he tried, you know, one or two runs that didn't quite work. First of all, on Elton, you can blame the player for being rusty and being poor on the day. But yeah, he was selected, and Test match rugby is not exactly where you go out and, you know, you shake off that rust. Yeah, if he hasn't played for 6-7 months, yeah, that's yeah, on the coaching team. There should have been an opportunity created for him somewhere to play, and I don't think Test rugby is the place for that. So as much as people are blaming Elton and he's an easy target for people, yeah, I think that's also a bit on the coaching staff that we're trying something. It was a gamble; it backfired on them. But yeah, when Willie LaRue came on the second half, I mean, you could see straight away the change in play. Him coming up behind the pods there and sort of directing play in the playmaking position, and suddenly Willem had a lot more freedom as well, and just the confidence seemed to rise. Not just there, in the back line as well. You suddenly saw balls. Yeah, in the first half, I think the ball went past 12 once. And in the second half, suddenly South Africa looked a lot stronger on the counter-attack with Lou, guiding them.
What was the atmosphere like, Brendan? A lot of people have been starved from rugby, full crowds for a long time. Did it feel like an occasion?
I definitely did. Now, listen, that was probably the best aspect of the entire day. I mean, I've sort of been at Loftus now. I've been covering rugby there for the last 20-odd years, and I've seen some big occasions there. This rivaled an All Black Springbok Test match in terms of atmosphere. I think you had people there starved of rugby. I mean, we were there probably about 5 hours before the game, and it was packed outside. The pubs were open. You know, people were just soaking in the atmosphere. It was a lovely day, quite warm for a winter's day here in South Africa. And it just, the atmosphere at Loftus is intimidating on a good day for an opposition team. I thought, on Saturday it was pretty intimidating to go walking along with the fans, and I think Wales did extremely well under the circumstances, with a crowd like that. I think the Box, it may affect the Box a bit more, just playing in front of a crowd at home for the first time in 3 years, and it was an absolutely amazing day of rugby.
Yeah, I mean, you forget how much you miss crowds like that, don't you? And I saw Dan Bigger talking after the game about, the level of feistiness in the game, but also facing an intimidating crowd, and it seemed like he really relished it. What can we expect from Bloemfontein?
I think more of the same. I'm one of those. I mean, I know there was a couple of people taken back by Dan Bigger's comments, but the Springboks are number one in the world. They're known for their physicality. They've got a target on their backs now as number one team in the world, and they've got to expect that. And they've got to be better than that. And I thought Wales got under their skin extremely well. And I have no problem with Dan Bigger's comments. I thought, at times I thought maybe it might have got close to boiling over, maybe a stricter referee might have taken the emotion down a little bit. But I think we're probably going to see the same. I don't see Wales backing off. I see them probably trying that again. Whether they've got enough, I still feel maybe that was their best chance against the Box. I don't think the Box will be as rusty the second time around, and I'm not sure Wales, if there's a player or two to injury, have got the same sort of depth that the Springboks have at the moment.
Yeah, speaking as a neutral, I can say that it was compelling stuff. I thought Dan Bigger spoke really well, and it felt like, as I said at the top, a proper Test match. Just last thing, Brendan, if you could pick out one thing that you think people should be aware of, or that we expect to be a bit different on the field this coming Saturday, what are you expecting?
Well, I'm expecting quite a different Springbok team, to be very honest. The Box made it quite clear last week that they're looking to give their whole 42-man squad a run through the three tests. And so I think from what we're hearing, you're going to get a couple of different players back. I mean, everyone's spoken about maybe Peter Steph de Toye returning, Andre Pollard returning, but I think you're going to see a couple of surprises there. Evan Riss, who anybody who's watched the URC will know how good he is. I think he's probably in line for his debut this week. Yeah, I think we're probably going to see somebody like Marcel Kutsia somewhere on the bench or in the team. You're going to see Andre Estes and might get a run as well. So Wales might face a bit of a different challenge this week, but I think the intensity will be the same.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, as promised, we've got to our final stop on the World Tour. We're off to Argentina. Yeah, we're going to talk about Scotland's loss to the Pumas here. Our own Matt Palmer is down there, and here's what he had to say about everything that happened at the weekend.
Dear me, I think we're all about out, Alan. It was certainly somewhat of a disappointing start, wasn't it? Literally nothing really went right from first to last. They played for about 10 minutes of the game at the start of the second half with a couple of tries that kind of dragged them back into it very briefly, but either side of that, it was a real mess, both in attack and defence. The saddest thing I think is it wasn't actually clear what they were trying to do, only that they were doing it very badly. So a fairly low bar set in terms of standards that they'll have to surpass this weekend, but you know, I think they know they're going to need to be masses better on just about every level and in every area to stand a chance in this second test.
So are we expecting a salt and Salta?
Well, there you go. You've just nicked one of my prospective intros for this week's copy, Alan. So I honestly don't see it getting much better. Also for the fact that, you know, that was the Pumas playing for the first time together since November. They're going to have had another week's training under their belt. They've seen what Scotland have to offer, or some of it at least. I think they will also put in a more rounded performance in the second game. So unfortunately, I think it is only going to get tougher at this stage.
Okay, now I want to ask about the direction of travel for Scotland at the moment, because it seems like they've been trending downwards in the last year. But firstly, you know, on the positive side, as you said, Puma's back in the saddle almost 3 years since they last played at home. You know, what was the atmosphere like? And, you know, how did they play? What did you make of the way that they played? Was there a sense that, you know, there was something bubbling under there?
Definitely, and there was a real kind of mix of, you know, what we've seen from some of the best Pumas teams down the years, that they, you know, obviously we know they're going to carry the fight to anyone up front. The fantastic pack, sort of both set piece and in the loose, those guys were who we name checked last week, were all fantastic. But there was also that queer undercurrent of wanting to move the ball at pace as well when the situations arose. There was clear attacking intent there, which told of the influence of Kontopomi and Michael Cheka. So I think they're trying to combine the sort of best of the old and new worlds there in terms of their traditions and building something a bit more expansive. So yes, definite positive signs from them. The atmosphere was terrific. It was great. As you can imagine, there was a real hunger to see this side in action, having not had that chance since, I think, August 2019. And up there in Jujuy, which we did pronounce correctly last week, I'm told.
Well done,
They hadn't had them since 2017. So there was a real obvious kind of... you know, expectation and excitement around the place all week when we were there, that they had them in town. They did what various kind of civic receptions and open training sessions and whatnot, so which were all mobbed. And then the venue itself was kind of old school South American football stadium, packed out from early on, noisy bands, lots of shouting and singing, lots of booing for the Scottish kickers. It was great. So from that point of view, a thoroughly enjoyable experience.
Because obviously, you were the lone Scotsman in the press box. You're the only lad that's travelled over to cover this series. So, chatting away in the press box to fellow writers, is there a sense amongst the pros that there's a bit of a Cheka effect already?
Definitely, and you can see that in terms of in terms of their own interactions with them. I think they're you know, they speak very positively of the impact he's made sort of off the field as well, in terms of better communication with them and a more openness around the place. And, you know, my Spanish is not the best, but I could, you know, I can appreciate that he was making a clear effort in his press conferences last week. He was, you know, switching pretty comfortably between the two languages. So, you know, I think there's been a lot of, not thankful or grateful, but, you know, I think they appreciate the effort that's been made from that front too. So, and again, you know, the vibe from that I got from them was that they were really keen to see this kind of new mix of, you know, traditional Pumas kind of values and playing style, but also trying to broaden their horizons a wee bit and introduce that attacking threat. And why wouldn't you, with, you know, some of those backs that they have, like Buffelli and Carreras and Sanchez, who unfortunately I think is going to miss the rest of the series with the injury picked up early doors on Saturday. But, you know, they've got a real kind of cluster of talent there in the back. So, you know, it makes sense to be trying to use it.
Okay, from a Scottish point of view, firefighting.
No.
What can be fixed short term? Maybe catching kickoffs would be a I mean, I feel like I've been saying that my entire lifetime, but restarts could be something that could be improved upon. Where do you think the easier wins? Nothing will be easy, but where the easier wins would be for Scotland improvement?
I think, you know, at a basic level, you know, playing guys in the right positions might be a great start. I know it's easy to be wise after the event, but, you know, Rory Hutchinson's been tearing it up all year with Northampton as a second playmaker outside Dan Biggar. He was okay at 15 at the weekend, but, you know, and in the flashes where Scotland were able to get him involved as first or second receiver, he looked, you know, every inch the player we know he can be. But I would love to see him getting a run at 12 this weekend in Salta. Also to take some of that burden off Blair Kinghorn, who, you know, as we all know, is a very novice 10 at this level and produced exactly the sort of performance you'd expect from someone you're describing in those terms. It was a very mixed bag, to put it politely. But, you know, I feel that having Hutchinson there with him would take some of the weight off him in terms of feeling he has to pull things out of his backside all the time. That would be one quick win. I think, you know, breakdown was a struggle again, and I think we'll probably see Rory Darge back in there at the weekend. He, you know, had what we thought was a season-ending knee injury with Glasgow at the back end of the campaign, but has made a miraculous recovery and, you know, came off the bench at the weekend. But I think his sort of ability over ball would be most useful. That's always assuming that Hamish Watson doesn't make it in readiness to start. Gregor, after the game at the weekend, said he thought we'd be involved in some capacity in this game. He picked up a week in a chest and shoulder injury the previous week. But if he doesn't start, then I'd like to see Darge in there. But, you know, never mind these sort of personnel issues. I think they just generally have to lift it and, you know, look like they want to be here as well. I felt like it took them so long to grow into the game at the weekend, which was unfathomable given, you know, the thing you could have predicted from a mile out was that the Pumas would make an exceptionally fast start with all that emotional win behind them, as we've just been talking about, the crowd and the desire to kind of produce for them after so long apart. And Scotland just didn't appear to be up for it in very basic terms for the best part of 40 minutes. So, you know, they really need to set their stall out early doors at the weekend, show that they're up for the fight in all senses, and you know, at least give themselves a swing a few punches, because that was the most disappointing thing at the weekend, that it felt they went down with having barely kind of showed anything in their armoury.
I've been desperately sitting here whilst you've been chatting, trying to think of a way to work Darge Healing Limited in, but I think that's maybe too niche of a movie reference or pun. Positives. Let's. Have there been any positives from your point of view from Scotland at the weekend? Was there anyone that showed up and you thought, okay, there's glimpses there?
Well, as I say, I'll stick with Hutchinson again. You know, I've been long been banging the drum to have him involved in some capacity. I think he's been grossly underused the last 3 years. So, you know, some of his handling and the line he hit for his try, you know, showed exactly the player that's in there. And we just have to find, or Scotland just have to find that, you know, a much better way of involving him more frequently in a game. And as I say, I think the answer to that is moving him to 12. Other than that, I'm struggling, to be honest. I'm not sure that anything merits including in that positives bag. But the one thing that they were all, you know, clinging to post match was that they felt that these things are fixable. And you know, I know we've all heard that many times, but you know, they clearly feel that it's within their gift to, you know, there was their own deficiencies that handed this on a plate to the Pumas. So. Whether or not that was actually the case, we'll discover as we go on, when we get a clearer picture of where Argentina are at as well. But, you know, certainly the vibe in the Scotland camp is that they can and must do a lot better.
Thanks to Mark Palmer for joining us from Argentina, as well as Brendan Nell from South Africa, Liam Napier from New Zealand, and the Brisbane 2. We'll be back again next week with more reaction and analysis from the summer tours. There's also the big Rugby World Cup qualifier coming up as Chile face the USA, so keep your eyes peeled for that. Thanks, as ever, to Alfie Reynolds for producing this podcast. Don't forget, follow or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're feeling generous, leave us a comment.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.